Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Symmetry of Souls' weekly two-hour study of the Urantia Papers. We're seeking to grasp the fifth epical revelation in a synthetic wholeness. Tonight, paper 123, section 5, paragraph 9. It's our arc, Jesus of Nazareth. What a transcendent service if through this revelation the Son of Man should be recovered from the tomb of traditional theology and be presented as the living Jesus. I'm Brad Garner. So glad that you're here with us live or in our archive at symmetryofsoul.org. There's not a lot of traditional theology about Jesus as a child, but there's some things out there, and more than anything, this is filling in the gaps, and we're glad that you're here with us. Tonight, it's Dr. Chris Halverson, Dave Tucker, Justin Armstrong, and of course, you. Won't you call up the text of the Urantia Papers as you see fit and join us in our study of this marvelous epical revelation? Hello there, Dr. Chris.
Hello, Brad, and hello to you, Justin and David, everyone who's joining us. Yeah, just a comment up front, you're talking about there isn't much theology about Jesus as a child or a young man. But there is sort of just the basic assumption that that whole time that isn't really recorded in the New Testament is the story of a fetish man, a fetish boy even, mm-hmm. fetish baby, and his magical doings. And, much more, of first importance than any specific detail they give us about his actual young life is just, getting us to set aside such, a silly, primitive notion as thinking of him in magical terms. It's like, no, it's Jesus the man, preceded by Jesus the boy, preceded right. by Jesus the baby.
Right.
Just like any of us. He is definitively merely human until the baptism. Yeah, after that, he's superhuman, yes. But before that, it's extremely important to not fetishize, the blob of protoplasm, as I so irreverently refer to us often. We all start out as this blob of protoplasm, and he did too, and he took delight in cultivating, and God lifted that up to something that became God-knowing and eventually God-conscious. And that's what we all need to set our sights on as well.
Thank you for that, Chris. Yeah, it's important to make sure that the vacuum that is left by the absence of this from the Bible isn't filled in with, like you say, some old wineskins of some magical thinking. And I don't have a strong memory of in any Christian tradition as a child of hearing much about Jesus as a kid, but there probably was some just implicit thought, well, he must have been a really, really supernatural kid. So we're seeing otherwise here. And good evening to you, Justin. How is everything out your way?
It's well. Good evening, Brad. Good evening, Dr. Chris, and good evening, David. To kind of dovetail onto what Chris was touching on, in the preface of 196, there's this wonderful sentence that states, "The Master's entire life was constantly conditioned by this living faith, this sublime religious experience." There's a truth in the fullness of even childhood where you can see this same predicate of living faith all the way through. And it's just wonderful to be studying it with you guys this evening.
Yeah. Yeah, likewise. And it's terrific also just to it's so precious and valuable to see how it got set up. What were these favorable conditions? How did Jesus become the man that he did by way of his culture, his parents, and tonight we'll look at his school. On and on it goes. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. Good evening there, David. How's everything going for you, and what can you tell us about last week?
Hey, Brad. I'm doing just wonderful. Hello to Justin and hello, Dr. Chris. Every time I hear Chris mention blob of protoplasm, I began instantly hearing the Gumby theme song in my mind. He was once a little blob of protoplasm. Anyway, yeah, I had a really fun time putting together the summary because throughout my studies throughout the week, I've been listening to the PHI audio library, and I figured, well, I'm at that time in my life where I really need to start from the beginning. So I jumped on over to the forward, and I think I'm about five episodes in, and section five, and I started realizing like the correlation of between like what you can learn from understanding the forward in a better, deeper sense, and how it carries forward. So it actually made a great impression on me while I was restudying last week's show and making a summary. So without any further delay, here's our summary. So by design, the revelation tells us that the universe is mind-planned, mind-made, and mind-administered. There is not one part that is not planned, made, and administered by mind, and that is not also fully coordinated in a wholeness. Everything and every being is transcendently designed and coordinated. It's no coincidence that the countless number of parts can be perfectly coordinated in a wholeness, as if by some random process could possibly produce such an enormous and harmoniously designed system. At the foundation of everything, there is an immutable absoluteness that connects all things and beings together. We need this foundation as a basis in our field of view at all times, regardless of the perceived difficulty in the subject we are reading about. No matter how dense, like the papers on the Supreme, or how seemingly surface level the text appears, like the Master's seventh year, we do well to keep this in our minds at all times. We all begin with a limited view that tends to focus on some of the specific details the revelation provides to us compared to, let's say, the New Testament. All of us need to set a guard upon making complete lifestyle solutions of this knowledge that's given to us through the revelation. It's entirely too common to get tunnel vision by the detailed specifics of the facts or be charmed by the poetic flurries and stay in the feelings each of those produce. The immediate face value of the text ultimately short-circuits our abilities to penetrate through to the truth that can be obeyed. We need recognition of fact and recognition of goodness. As a consequence of having both, we can see the truth flowing above each of them. Truth can be hungered for. Truth can be obeyed. And truth is the constant carrot on the stick in front of us that is never satiated because there are always progressive and deeper qualities of it to be discovered and chosen each and every step of the way. In the 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 22, it says, "You have made your souls pure by obeying the truth through the Holy Spirit." The stairway that leads upwards to truth is free from the trampled footprints of the masses. It's narrow, like a bike lane intended for a single traveler. It is far less traveled because it takes independent courage. But such is the Father's way. Most of us, busied with the self-delights and recognition of fact or goodness, and ground our good ships upon the rocks just short of the attainment of truth because we hunger not for it. Instead, we allow our once insatiable hunger to get satisfied by a mere taste of it. Humility and patience go a long way here and keep the stomach full and yet hungry for more simultaneously. In the section of the seventh year, 81, we discuss that there is a recognition to be discovered in the concept of play that is mind-made, mind-managed, and mind-administered. The precision of the organized aspects of play can foster the beginnings of the scientific consciousness and the potentials for values, and associativity consciousness developed is also discoverable in play as well. The importance of play life in general can be abstracted from Jesus of Nazareth's play life by readers who maintain their curiosity past the surface level text that we all begin with and who humbly and patiently are open to being revealed to. The importance to the maturation of a child. There's even a religious nucleus that is being fostered and augmented through children at play with acceptable playfellows. There is always something that subtly augments the formation of that religious nuclear religious life, even with play. The young Jesus cooperatively subordinated himself to the Ten Commandments by remembering the Sabbath day to keep it holy and honoring his father and mother, Commandments 4 and 5. He was obedient to those laws when many others with less than favorable home life would easily develop a better way. Jesus had exhibited an unquestioning loyalty. It's a lesson all of us who read the Revelation must take to heart. If the Revelation says, do such and so, you do well to do it unquestioningly and without hesitation. Religiously, even. Having the knowledge of how the Master turned out, we study these papers of his early life to understand how he got that way. A solid religionist. The Revelators tell us about a real accident that occurs as he took a spill down his steps during a sandstorm. But the result of Mary being riddled with anxiety over the ordeal was an error in that is what was mistaken judgment. Trust in God is the only antidote to all anxiety, and we are told to abandon it in favor of this sublime trust. Of course, she did birth the creator of our universe, so she gets some slack of her anxiety. Intervention. Interestingly, in this section, the midwayers bring up the subject of how ordinary circumstances, only midwayers can intervene in the safeguarding of the persons of men and women of destiny. But in paper 113, section 5, paragraph 5, they mention how certain instances, seraphic guardians have acted, and properly, on their own initiative. School days in Nazareth. The young Jesus was a fluid reader and writer in three languages by 7 years old. Take a breath. Remind yourself you are a perfecting child of God, and we're not in competition with the Master, but we can see at how, at a very young age, early age, Jesus was curious and followed his curiosity with action. When we reflect on how different a child in that setting with religious parents and acceptable playfellows and scientific and religious curiosity would end up versus how most children end up now, we see the value of starting a child off in the law of God compared to the false notions that focus on teaching their children about only the love of God. The Revelators are giving us instructions to follow here, parents. We do well to heed to them. The foundation of the first epical revelation wasn't to tell us about love and service. It was to teach us about law and order. The Master became a religious adult because his foundation was in law. If your family life is founded on love and service, your family life is humanistic and is devoid of survival value, God-knowingness, and God-ascension. It's the same pattern for your national life as well. Divine law are the habits of God. And when law and order comes first, then your potential for survival value is present for you to take forward to the next sequence. This ends our summary.
That was delightful, David. Thank you so much. I like the way your style of writing is evolving, and it's still a very compelling way to present the material. Brought a lot of things back to mind. Thank you for putting in the effort. Really glad.
Yeah, well done, David.
And
Thanks, David.
Go ahead. Go ahead, Chris. I was wondering if there were any clarifications or, points to discuss.
I wasn't quite certain, but I just wanted to make sure because we so often touch upon it, well, I invoke it, that those alternative thoughts relative to error and evil that follow the inevitabilities. You were referring to them there, and just make sure it's clear when they say that that you're talking about Mary's anxiety, so that she quote unquote unwisely tried to keep Jesus very close to her side. Unwise judgment, quote unquote, is error, and mistaken judgment, quote unquote, is evil. They aren't indicating that there's evil, error. That it was unwise judgment. But as you said, we can't help but cut her a little bit of slack for this great anxiety. But the counter is to not just focus on that and say, well, I think I have something analogous and I can cut myself some slack. You don't want to start by cutting yourself slack. You want to start by challenging yourself that where you can, you cannot have relationship to truth short-circuited just because the challenge before you becomes very vivid or extreme in some way. I mean, the point is to be able to maintain your cosmic poise in the face of challenges, rugged challenges that you must face. The whole point of wisdom is to be able to handle more difficult situations than you can without it. If you just immediately say, well, I'm wise, but I can't expect myself to be wise if the going gets tough. It's like, no, that's the whole point of wisdom, is to have something when the going gets tough. Something in your mind that's above the part of your mind that normally handles, the day-to-day issues, so that it stands unmoved when the day-to-day issues become, very challenging. Right? Because that level of wisdom is innately transcendent to, what you're doing to just navigate the immediacies.
Thank you for that clarification. And just my first thought that came up when you're mentioning that is, as a father, especially a father of younger children, we have ample opportunity to practice and exercise this wisdom. And just this morning, I remember giggling to myself about how irritated I got just because my kids were running late and, just not following simple directions. And then I remember giggling and saying, well, yeah, you prayed for this, old Davy boy. So here's an opportunity to practice that patience and humility you talked to God about so fervently. And I'm in the habit of just saying nothing, and that's better than saying the wrong thing. So I'm at that process. I'm sure it'll evolve into something better. But for right now, saying nothing is a lot better than saying something out of, frustration, for instance. So I can relate.
Remember, everyone, if you pray for wisdom and they answer your prayer, they answer with more tribulations.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm glad you said remember that, Chris. That seems to be the problem. No matter how many times we pray and we think we're praying in this, enlightened orientation with respect to the epical revelation, when troubles come, we always, the animal part of us would rather than not be there. It's a very basic observation. It's like we just forget between the praying and then the event happening. We just can't hold it in our heads.
It's very important to remember that no one can produce the willful insight within you that produces super additively the wisdom. Right? I mean, the only thing that those outside of your inner life, which is everyone, can do in response to your request for wisdom, you know, is do something about the external element, the tribulation. You can't do anything about the internal element, the reflection. So any prayer for wisdom, you know, if it is answered, is they build a speed bump, or maybe a bigger speed bump, and then see what you do with it.
Now, there you go.
Is it wrong for me to be banking on the fact that my soul doesn't reflect truth like a mirror, therefore it's not being heard?
I think if Andrew was here, there would be, you know, a reinvocation about the Cheetos, you know, comment that we so often
right.
bring up.
Can't I just go back to the way things were? Yeah. The problem,
you know, regarding
is just
regarding your soul, Dave. The one more reference I can't help myself from the preface of 196. There's a statement where they're talking about the master's prayer life, and they use the phrase, and the mighty mobilization of the combined soul powers to withstand all human tendencies towards selfishness, evil, and sin. So that inner life top-down influence, in terms of praying for wisdom, you're literally the upper domain of spiritualized mind is the part of you that in the inner life that is capable of having that genuine ability to stay founded and predicate yourself on the Father's will, as opposed to falling back into those human tendencies.
Amen to that.
Yeah. Those human tendencies will be here with us all of our lives, though, and the contending with them is part of the nature of this life we have to live. There's some transcendent divine wisdom in setting ourselves against ourselves in an effort to be human, in trying to transcend that which we are by nature.
Yeah. I mean, just, you know, you can consider the Revelator's use of the word strive. You know, just a simple little study sometime to examine all the times they're talking about striving, you know, and again, that the whole point is that if you don't strive against the material gravity that would like to keep you just as you were born, then you don't go anywhere. You certainly don't go up.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's you must strive against the natural if you are to survive.
Yeah.
It's funny, I can recall several times in my personal prayers that I've, let's just say, zealously prayed for some advancement and then recognize, oh, yeah, they're going to answer it in a way that you probably don't want it to happen. And then I go, well, you know, Lord, all within what I'm capable of withstanding, right? is this going to change the direction somehow? Like, I'm already in too far. You guys got to take it. You know, Dave, just sit and take it.
And lately,
you
I found
I was
myself
careful to say, if they answer your prayer, right? I mean, you know, there's wisdom on the other end here. But, you know, if they judge that you can handle, you know, the burner being turned up, then they turn the burner up.
Yeah.
All right. Well, a topic that I wanted to maybe see if there's anything to pull on here, since, David, you mentioned in your review Mary's anxiety, and it got me thinking about a very oft-quoted passage from paper 48 of the Urantia book about anxiety. Anxiety must be abandoned. The disappointments hardest to bear are those which never come. Now, that's a statement of human philosophy that is a downstepped version of some kind of Urantia Moda on high. But and it's based upon, you know, human statements. I think it was I've got James Russell Lowell here who wrote, "Let us be of good cheer, remembering that the misfortunes hardest to bear are those which never come." You know, so these are ideas that have been in circulation for some time. But I wonder One thing that happened when the Revelators took this, the first one, I should say, anxiety must be abandoned. That seems like that might come from, Horace Bushnell. Anxiety is a word of unbelief or unreasoning dread. We have no right to allow it. Full faith in God puts it to rest. So, if that's where they were playing off of, he didn't use the word abandoned. And I found myself wondering, why did the Revelators use the word abandoned to describe what we do with anxiety? That doesn't, it's not the same as anxiety must be squashed. It must be suppressed. It must be, whistled past the graveyard and pretended it's not there, should not be medicated away. It's abandoned. And what are they telling us? Because people love to throw this number 19 item out, and then they often puzzle over it because it seems impossible. How are we supposed to abandon anxiety in this life? It doesn't feel like we can.
Yeah, your lower domain can't abandon anxiety. It can't abandon fear.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And yet there it says it should be abandoned, and Jesus said, fear not. And I mean, when someone makes a declaration like that, I mean, what they're actually testifying is that they have no current experiences in contrast to their lower domain. That the only experiences that they have so far in life are fancy animal ones, where you're perforce subject to that master of anxiety that generates anxiety and fear. So, again, until one finally discovers that there's that there's a higher basis upon which a reciprocal phase of your mind can function. Right? I mean, you can't change your whole mind, but there are contrasting reciprocal phases. There's one that's based on your biology and one that's based on the cosmos.
Mm.
Right? And they meet in the middle in the hourglass analogy, right in the neck. Initially, no one has the slightest clue that there's this reciprocal alternative. 180-degree different point of view. You can see someone who's, 60, 70, 80 years old, still talking, testifying that, they've yet to have any experience in their life that, that would challenge their assumption that in this life there's one master.
Right. Right. Well, it's such a baked-in assumption in our world today. I mean, people who have truly found a way above this might be described. Some people might look at them and say they're out of their mind, and technically they're onto something. They are out of their animal origin mind. They are beside themselves. Yes, they are not standing within their animal origin self. They are standing beside it or above it. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, and again, it's, see, again, that's why they speak that way about abandoning. I mean, it's just, you can't somehow get rid of it. But you can abandon, that, fundamental basis in much of your life. As we all point out, even when you take the superhuman Jesus post-baptism, all the way through towards the end, just before the crucifixion, so a well-matured superhuman Jesus, even that Jesus has Gethsemane.
Yeah.
He didn't somehow, magically erase his biologic foundation. It's still there, even way post-baptism. And it can still produce a material gravity so strong that it momentarily overcomes the Creator Son's control.
Yeah, even after he's after baptism, after all these advanced steps, he's effectively it's still there because perforce it's still there.
And that just reminds you that, see, the way I said that, it could even overcome the Creator's Son's control. It's like, well, that's not possible. Yes, it is. The Creator's Son is a finite being. The Isle of Paradise is an absolute. The Creator's Son loses unless he exercises a counterbalancing absoluteness.
Right.
The absolute dimension of his personality that can choose something, choose an absolute in contrast to the absolute of matter and individuality, the aisle. Yeah. So if you don't, see again, just to re-stress the striving thing, you have to strive against being flattened into the pancake like the aisle by material gravity. You have to strive up against that. When all is said and done, you literally have to strive against an absolute. And that's obviously not possible just in mere isolation with that absolute. Yeah, your only way out is relative to some other absolute.
Go ahead, Brad.
Oh, just I've got to say, like, the imagery of the metaphor of the Isle of Paradise is a pancake. Don't become a pancake. That'll probably stick with me. That's vivid, and as far as I can tell, Chris, novel. Congratulations.
Yeah, well, it's a variation on my Flatlander analogy that I so often invoke, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that material gravity, he wants to flatten you down into the plane of the Flatlander.
Yeah,
right?
It does.
So nothing of up.
He wants to do the same thing to mountains. It weathers them down and tries to make the whole Earth the same elevation and level. Yeah, that's what material gravity does.
One giant plane, right?
Right, exactly.
Not a single monadnock left.
Exactly. Go ahead, Justin.
I was just going to state that always keeping in mind, instead of the dichotomy side where you're looking at a quote-unquote negative emotion like neuroticism in just one dimension and absolutizing it, the goal is to always see it in terms of the differential and to be able to say, okay, somebody who's high in neuroticism, they're highly sensitive, and someone who's low in neuroticism tends to be very confident, but you don't want to go all in either of those directions. You want to have that symmetry, that balance of character that the master demonstrated, where in certain moments a little sensitivity is appropriate, in other moments a little confidence is appropriate. So the differential allows us to navigate the nuances of one specific temperamental quality like anxiety or neuroticism.
I mean, and again, you tend to have one bin or the other down in the plane. Material gravity will drag you down, and it doesn't somehow allow you to be in both bins at the same time so that you can balance them.
You need to manage that, yes.
Only way to be able to balance is to get yourself up out of that plane.
Yes.
Where you don't have any choice, really. You just are your fixed biology.
Well, it's certainly it's the same lesson. We touch on this pretty often here. Going up, transcending your animal origin self. But I appreciate exploring one of those Marantxa Moto, one of the more often quoted ones. I like the one about hornet nests, but <must be. laughs> it's even more vivid than a pancake. All right.
Yeah, and probably one thing to remind everyone in passing before we leave that behind. Okay, so we have these, these reciprocal alternatives. One is fraught with anxiety, and the other, has no naturalness of relationship to anxiety. However, you have free will, and you can drag that lower domain anxiety up into the upper domain as a poison.
Right.
Right? There's nothing in the lower domain that you can't spiritualize. Right? Because you have absolute free will in that upper domain. You can, you know, you can bring absolutely anything into play there. You know, your most basal, unfortunate biology can be, you know, copied up into the upper domain as an element of your personality management of that domain. You can spiritualize it.
Right.
And so, you know, they also often, you know, talk about those poisons like that.
Well, you wonder, well, not to get into the physics of transit to the Marantia spheres, but, you know, if you don't get an adjutant, if you don't get animal origin stuff in the next life, you wonder what would that anxiety poison look like when it's resurrected? There must be still some shadow that it would cast that could cause you to act poorly and unwisely and even wrong in the afterlife.
Yeah, it just, you know, there'll be the essence of it in the matrix of your soul. And you have to try to overcome that in the first dimension world. In other words, you know, you need to reform your soul on those first dimension worlds. So there's no longer a generator for such asymmetries, such cross currents, such imbalances in your mind.
Boy. Sounds, well, everyone likes to think of the fantasy land of the afterlife that sounds like it'd be easy to do. Sounds like it would be effortless to do. Everyone, the teachers will do it for us, and all you have to do is just sit back and get an A on the exam. But, you know, I'm starting to reflect on it and say, I don't know if it's that easy. If you've got anxiety as a matrix, the essence of that, as a matrix of your soul, you have a very strong identification with it. It feels like it is you. It's part of you. It's part of the cosmos. And you might chafe if a teacher comes in and says you need to reform that away. You might say, no, this is me. I can see how this could be hard.
Yeah. You know, I mean, we can come up with very clever rationalization schemes to convince ourselves that this is a positive, not a negative.
Yeah. It's awareness. Let me have my awareness. You want me to be aware, don't you, teacher? Yeah.
Right. Yeah, and again, too, it's fundamentally an upper domain issue, that, and not even the Universal Father can modify your soul. You know, let alone some, you know, Melchizedek teacher, say, you know, on the Mansion World. Only you can modify your soul. Yeah, and so you'll be striving to modify it.
Righto. Justin, was there another comment you
no,
had there?
No, I'm good. Thank you, though.
Okay. Well, great discussion. Anything else reflecting on David's summary from last week before we commence with the reading? All right. Well, again, thank you, David, for putting the time in for that. It gives plenty to think about. And just as a quick reminder, it's good to do this every so often. We do have a website, symmetryofsoul.org. Not sure where you're listening to this, but symmetryofsoul.org is our website. You can find all of our past episodes. We're at almost 700 of them now, ranging over some 14 years almost, along with the written summaries like what David just delivered tonight, as well as a number of cross-references and other little pages that have been cobbled together, mostly by yours truly here with chicken scratch writing. And also, there's a link to our new Friday podcast. That's when our new episode's released. It's a shorter form. We're here tonight, two-hour format, but we have a 20 to 25-minute complimentary, we hope, podcast that touches on some of the same topics and tries to parallel the readings here on Symmetry of Soul. So check it out if you care to, symmetryofsoul.org. All right. With that self-promotion out of the way. Let's get with the reading. We are in paper 123 of the Urantia Papers, The Early Childhood of Jesus. We're picking up in section 5, School Days in Nazareth. We're starting at paragraph 9. We got through part of about half of this section, and now we're going to commence here at paragraph 9, which is page 1363 of the original single-column publication. Throughout his years at the synagogue, he was a brilliant student, that's Jesus, of course, possessing a great advantage since he was conversant with three languages. The Nazareth Hazan, on the occasion of Jesus's first finishing of the on the occasion of Jesus finishing the course in his school, remarked to Joseph that he feared he had learned more from Jesus' searching questions than he had been able to teach the lad.
So this is a great little starting point here to, you know, again, pick up on this basic issue we've been already talking about so far in the show. Of, you know, what's the difference between your animal origin, you know, master side of your mind, and the reciprocal side? Now, what's the difference between engaging the world, you know, basically as a fancy animal, and, you know, in contrast to engaging as a human, an actual human, even a real human, you know, one could
right.
say. And the key is there. I mean, Jesus is developing human experiences, you know, so much so that, you know, it's causing his teacher to begin to have more human experiences than he's had up to that point in his life.
Hmm.
Yeah, and what do we mean by human experiences? If you go to paper 102, section 4, paragraph 2, which is 1123, yeah, here we're in paper 123, now we're on page 1123. You know, that paragraph starts out, what is human experience? Right? And you think, well, that's a silly thing to be in this book. It's like, no, the greatest minds have ever lived have been trying to answer the question and haven't been able to. So for the first time in human history, there's a definitive answer to that question. In the fifth epical revelation, it's that next sentence. What is human experience? It is simply any interplay between an active and questioning self and any other active and external reality. We don't want to go off. I'm explaining the fullness of that external, but just the first part I don't want to focus on. It doesn't say an interplay between merely an active, you know, self and, you know, an external reality. That would indicate merely an animal, even the fullness of a fancy animal only.
Right.
You know, and so that would be just an animal experience, the interplay between just an active self and an external reality. In order for it to be a human experience, it has to be active in questioning. And notice the questioning is the foundational part, right? Fundamentally pointing it, approaching it in the reciprocal way from the top down. And so it's impossible to be, supplying favorable conditions to be grown into a creature that is more and more of a human quality instead of merely animal. If you aren't questioning, it's the fundamental, foundational element to anything, you know, subsequently, that questioning self. And so that's why they're stressing that here. You know, you're to understand how Jesus could have accomplished things, you know, while his age is still in single digits, you know, and you're looking at yourself and going, well, I'm a little bit older than that, and I'm still not there. What have I been missing in my life? Well, without knowing anything about who's asking that question right now, I can tell you foundationally, everyone gets the same answer. You didn't have adequate questioning in your life. You have to activate that reflective upper domain. with searching questions, probing questions, incessant questions, challenging questions.
I wonder if...
Go ahead, Brad.
Maybe just quickly here, can I just poll those who have children? So everyone knows that Jesus was not the only child who was ever one continuous question mark. And, you know, stand-up comedians make a lot of hay out of children asking why. Like, you know, what is my question? Like, briefly, I wonder what anyone's experience was with that, because it certainly seems we are wired to be born active and questioning selves, certainly active, but there are a lot of parents who are like, okay, that is too many whys in a row, or, well, not right now, we've got to have dinner, and sometimes that's practically true, but it seems like this suggests that there really ought to be no limits to the amount of patience a parent will have with a questioning child, whereas it's very popular to say, no, kids will just play you. You got to know when to just lay down the law or just ignore them. So I don't know if anyone
I want to make sure up front that everyone understands. You can program a computer to ask questions.
Yeah, right.
Right. You know, and a pre, encirclement in the Holy Spirit child, right, is programmed to ask questions. But the questions that we're talking about here are the real questions that have a reflective basis, you know, that can begin to happen in Jesus' case after he's, you know, about 4.5 years old, right, or, you know, on average about age 6, right, after a child has that upper domain. Right? It's fundamentally, it has to be, you know, not some sort of just instinct in the lower domain that asks a question.
Mm.
Right?
Yeah.
That's just curious, right? But a reflective-based question.
Yeah, and I think that the difference, Brad, is the type of questions that lead to genuine human experience are in that sequence of discover, recognize, interpret, and choose modality. But a lot of children, I think, in general, their questions are more clever in trying to kind of determine the power hierarchy in getting what they want when they want it.
Right. That's the exasperating part so much comedians make a joke out of. You're procrastinating bedtime. I know you are.
So if I were to do this, what would be your response? These conniving questions, right? I mean, yeah, again, you know, some, you know, not you know, the machinations of a clever animal. Right. See, or even now, you know, like you pointed out, that little human child doesn't just ask any old question. You know, they very interestingly, well before roughly age 6, will ask the why question. See, and technically they have no personal basis for that word being in their vocabulary.
Right.
But the life carriers have designed us so that even before you can originate the question why, it's on your lips. So that, you know, it's as immediate as possible, you know, once you are encircled in the Holy Spirit, to go, oh, why? Oh, I get it. And you take personal possession of that question and carry it forward. But, you know, the question was, you know, has been on your lips for years, and you kind of, so it's sitting there in front of your eyes when your eyes are opened finally, so that you can take a hold of it and run with it. I mean, a rabbit,
yeah,
you know, isn't programmed by the life carriers, you know, to blurt out the question, why? No matter how old it is, right? But,
Right. Before we can originate it, we can parrot it. We've seen others do it, and we can, well, and it's preparing
very much
us.
Like
it's,
prayer, you know, prayer being hardwired into you before you have any ability to originate it or, you know, take any personal possession of it. It's just hardwired in, right? The machine is programmed by the life carriers to do that.
Yeah, and that's where you could take that word striving that you were touching upon prior to our reading this evening, Chris, and you could recognize that the whole universe, the whole cosmos is in this process of striving. It's not just merely a mode that can be applied to your personality management. It's something, there's a motion in play. it just is. Everything is in motion. Everything is striving for a greater purpose. Do you want to be a part of it?
Right. You know, so you have some natural motion, and then you can choose unnatural motions, right? You know, augmenting your motion. So, you know, all these foundational modalities that subsequently you can reflectively go, oh, well, that's not a coincidence, that I was already kind of leading up to an originative nature. Thank you, life carriers, for being, you know, so considerate to program that into me. So, you know, it was sort of just waiting there for me to pick up and run with. Right, you know, if none of that stuff was programmed in, imagine how difficult this might be to just slowly wandering in the wilderness and stumble upon this.
Well, Andon and Fanta, I mean, they wouldn't have even had a culture that they could have inherited that they could have conceivably done it. It's got to get started somewhere. Yeah.
Yeah.
Throughout his course of study, Jesus learned much and derived great inspiration from the regular Sabbath sermons in the synagogue. It was customary to ask distinguished visitors, stopping over the Sabbath in Nazareth, to address the synagogue. As Jesus grew up, he heard many great thinkers of the entire Jewish world expound their views, and many also who were hardly Orthodox Jews, since the synagogue of Nazareth was an advanced and liberal center of Hebrew thought and culture.
Yeah, so you had this very, you know, helpful liberality, you know, this you know, relative freedom of speech, you know, that, you know, so coincidentally they're away from, you know, Judea, where, you know, there's much less freedom of speech, you know, as it were.
Right.
You know, because of, you know, people overplaying morality. You know, morality is an indispensable basis to religion, but all good things taken to extreme, you know, start to eat away at the foundation here. So, you know, and of course you can obviously reflect on how when you throw out, you know, a religious orthodoxy, right, orthodoxy doesn't disappear. It's not like the sixth adjutant disappears. You know, you'll just generate a secularist orthodoxy, you know, that will become ever more militant. And there we are, you know, like we so often point out, paper 195, section 8.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, one of the reasons, you know, for bringing up issues like this about Jesus' life is, you know, not just to fully understand his developmental environment, right, but to see how, oh yeah, there's a truth there that transcends the 2,000 years, and there we are in the midst of, you know, a new, ever more oppressive orthodoxy.
You know, maybe this would be as good of an opportunity. I mentioned this briefly at the end of the last show, and we don't need to belabor it. It's just in the same way that the language can drift, language can change over time. You know, we were once reading a paper where the word bisexual is used, It is not the common sense of the word today, so we had to pause here and just talk about the etymological thing of it. This is the densest occurrence of the word liberal in the Urantia book, this section, 123.5. It's five times in this one section. That word is a lot of charge and caveats with it, a lot of baggage these days. In what sense are they meaning that word here?
One of the very first things that should come to mind when you think of a proper usage of the word liberal, like you have here, is what I just said a minute ago: freedom of speech, freedom of thought. Right? That you have, in your inner life, you have liberty. Right, and we were just talking about that's a sovereign domain. No one can corrupt that except you. You could shackle your own liberty. But stemming down and out from that domain of your liberty, is some expression of freedom. Right? And so, that liberal, liberty-like, the A-L suffix meaning like, right? So you have some downstepped expression, right, down and out, that's liberty-like, right? A liberalness, in other words, a freedom, right? Some basic freedoms that are a proper external expression of the preeminence of the individual, their inner life, their liberty.
To bind up the brokenhearted.
Freedom of religion, freedom of speech, right? Freedom of thought.
Right.
Right. Like a liberal education is an education where, there is a freedom, a non-rigid orthodoxy. Right? I mean, liberal and orthodox are the contrasting words. Right? So you can either, orthodox means straight, so you can force everyone to be on this singular straight line, orthodox, right? Or you can allow for lines at many angles.
Yeah.
And you can sort through those and consider those. See, I mean, they're talking about Jesus he could listen to a wide range of thoughts and sort through them. Reflectively, he could challenge himself to get above all those thoughts with his human self so that he can reflectively sort through them and consider them, grade them. Well, that was better than that one, and et cetera. And what's his basis for better? Is it some sort of bottom-up orthodoxy? Right? It's better because it's more precisely conformal to an orthodoxy? No. He's judging it from the top down. That one's better because that one's, more conformal with the truth, with the cosmos.
And coincidentally, the text we're going to read shortly that he chose from Isaiah happens to state, to proclaim liberty to the captives and to set the spiritual prisoners free. Both of those concepts that Chris was just touching upon happen to be in the very text.
Oh, sure. Just skip ahead and, spoil it.
Not the full. I didn't read the full text, just a part of it.
Hey, there's no spoiler here. We've all pre-read. We've all pre-read, I'm sure. Didn't you?
Right. I mean, and again, it's very important to kind of, and with every word in the Revelation, you can't interpret the word in some twisted, debased, contorted way like so many words tend to be used today.
Right.
You need to get back to the logic of the truth of those words. And that's how the revelators are using them. If you don't, obviously, you're not going to properly interpret, passages of the, you're going to go off on a false tangent.
Yeah. That was me with the word travesty a few weeks ago, and I've had that cleared up. So yes.
Yeah, and see, obviously, there's there's a blind spot when you adopt a liberality of mind, where you overplay it. All good things taken to extreme become bad, and you overplay it, and the next thing you know, you're compromising with evil and consorting with sin in the name of liberality. You know, you'll even support illiberality in the name of liberality. Right? So, always a problem historically. When you open up to free yourself from some orthodox shackles, can you keep that liberality in cosmic check? Right? Or are you you're just going to end up, out of the frying pan into the fire? But again, back to your immediate question.
Yeah.
It just means that, whereas in Judea, good luck going, to the synagogue there and hearing a wide range of perspectives on, the Pentateuch, right, the five books of the law. No, there's one proper way, and if you stray from that, they stone you to death.
Good luck, and certainly good luck going to that Judean synagogue and finding a teacher who would say, "Well, I'm actually learning from this student." I've got to be honest; I don't think that would happen there because that's not orthodox to say that.
And again, the point is not just to merely break free from an orthodoxy, and then have six of one, half a dozen another, liberally accessible options.
Right.
The point of having those options, like they're talking about, Jesus had presented before him, so he could get above them. You leverage off of them and go up. It's like, wow, if I'm going to sort this out, I need to get above all of these trees so I can see the forest. There's that opinion tree and that opinion tree and that opinion tree. See, so it's a means to an end. It's not an end in itself. That liberality. Something to reflectively sort through. I mean, you can't reflectively sort through one option.
Right.
And in the same way that the angels of the churches are always checkmating the angels of progress in our own minds, we should always keep that level of the foundation in play while we are attempting to expand our cosmic consciousness.
Right, and like I was saying, that because there isn't that, historically liberals don't end up conserving their liberality. They end up losing it, right, to illiberals.
It does seem to be the drift. Yeah.
See, conservation is not, at odds with liberality. It's a necessary complement.
Yes.
What's at odds with liberality is orthodoxy.
Yeah,
right?
No, I get that.
And conservation is not orthodoxy. Preservation is orthodoxy.
Yeah, and I liked what you said there, Chris. We can move on. I liked what you said about trying to get above all these lines of thought. I think there's something, almost an ism, that can be built out of, I might call it complexism, or maybe it's relativism, like just basking in the complexity of it all, just seeing all the lines of thought and cataloging them and indexing them and shrugging and saying, well, I'm weary. Who can say which one of these is true? What is truth? And sort of giving up and just staying down in the plane with them. The key is for these to push you to get above them. It's so important.
And one last thought to share on what you just stated, Brad. It's the difference between the legacies of the past, the traditions of the present, and the conventions of the future versus utilizing genuine upper domain wisdom, wisdom, insight, and foresight. That's what you're touching upon.
Mm-hmm.
journey, and it's just, you know, it's very, you know, one of the reasons why the book is here is because, you go back to prior to the 20th century, and there's this liberality that's, coming into play during the Enlightenment, but instead of everyone, challenging themselves to go upward and establish a more reflective human nature, instead, you just spread out a whole bunch of different options, and everyone, pooled, relative to one option based upon their biologic temperament.
Right.
Ooh, I like that option. So you're saying that's a good option because it's pleasant to you. So now you become the definition of goodness. We didn't meet the challenge. You could say that the Supreme gave mankind an opportunity, in contrast to orthodoxy, with some liberality, and mankind failed the test. And so the Supreme will take it back. Some sort of orthodoxy will be reestablished for stability. And there's this very dire possibility that could be a secularist orthodoxy instead of a religious one.
Yeah, which that will not stay stable for long. That will fly apart just like a solar system without a sun at the center. But it won't be pretty as it's happening.
Yeah. Disaster is the word to use.
Yes,
we'll be
exactly.
Apart from the stars.
Yeah. When entering school at 7 years, at this time the Jews had just inaugurated a compulsory education law, it was customary for the pupils to choose their birthday text, a sort of golden rule to guide them throughout their studies, one upon which they often expatiated at their graduation when 13 years old. The text which Jesus chose was from the prophet Isaiah. "The Spirit of the Lord God is upon me, for the Lord has anointed me. He has sent me to bring good news to the meek, to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, and to set the spiritual prisoners free."
Okay, so compulsory education, specifically compulsory religious education.
Indeed.
Note that. we don't have that. There used to be, and everyone was going to church, there was, at least a traditional religious education. You had Sunday school. Just so many things, I remember when I expatiated on my birthday text when I was 13. Sure.
That's what Mario Brothers looked like. Yeah, of course. Yeah. Right.
That
video
happen.
Games.
The contrast of that with today is so striking. Okay, but now, of course, anyone who knows the Revelation, even without the Revelation, you kind of have a sense from the New Testament. Jesus played off of this opening verse in Isaiah 61 many, many times, right? And, directly and indirectly throughout the course of his life and his public ministry.
Mm-hmm. Right?
This was a very foundational text to everything in his life. And we won't go off in the details, but you can think about how in this context, the midwayers are cleaning up a direct play off of the King James Version of Isaiah 61:1, so that it's very clear that, in truth, the passage is all about the inner life, not the outer life. Right, especially if you start talking about freeing prisoners, say no spiritual prisoners, right? And and the liberty of the inner life, like I was saying, in contrast to a down-and-out expression of some freedom. And another, you know, key element there, we can think about the Beatitudes, right, in the ordination sermon, when he brings up meek, right, and how important it is to get out of some old wineskin like your dictionary, probably, about the word meek, right? I mean, in the Revelation, that means faith submission to the Father's will. And so, he's saying that he, Jesus, has been sent to bring good news to those who are in faith submission to the Father's will, but bad news to those that aren't.
Right, sure.
That's the point. As the Beatitude says, I mean, it's not those who aren't in faith submission to the Father's will will inherit the earth.
To add to that really quickly, in 149:6, there's a reference, "You do well to be meek before God and self-controlled before men, but let your meekness be of spiritual origin and not the self-deceptive display of a self-conscious sense of self-righteous superiority."
And again, like I said, I mean, you know, that sort of very kind of direct defining of it, you know, is, you know, by the midwayers in when they're expanding upon the Beatitudes. You have, you know, what you mean by poor in spirit, right? That's
right.
Humble, right? And what you mean by meek is faith submission to the Father's will. Yeah, and those are just a couple of simple definitions of terms that are important to carry through your, no matter where you're reading the Revelation,
unless you go off on
a false tangent.
And apparent for me, at least, the most common false tangent is defining something by its near homonym. Tragedy is like travesty is like tragedy. Meek is like weak. I'm like, no, stop it. Those just sound alike.
Yes, they both start with a T, but then there's a differentiation. I usually don't get past the first letter.
I'm busy. All right. Let's see. David, would you like to take the reading from here?
Of course. We're at Nazareth was one. But...
Yes.
Yep.
Okay. Nazareth was one of the 24 priest centers of the Hebrew nation. But the Galilean priesthood was more liberal in the interpretation of the traditional laws than were the Judean scribes and rabbis. And at Nazareth, they were more liberal regarding the observance of the Sabbath. It was therefore the custom of Joseph to take Jesus out for walks on Sabbath afternoons, one of their favorite jaunts being to climb the high hill near their home, from which they could obtain a panoramic view of all of Galilee. To the northwest, on clear days, they could see the long ridge of Mount Carmel running
Carmel.
Down to the Carmel. I had a Freudian slip there. Running down to the sea. And many times Jesus heard his father relate the story of Elijah, one of the first of the long line of Hebrew prophets who reproved Ahab and exposed the priest of Baal. To the north, Mount Hermon raised its snowy peak in majestic splendor and monopolized the skyline, almost 3,000 feet of the upper slopes glistening white with perpetual snow. Far to the east, they could discern the Jordan Valley, and far beyond, the rocky hills of Moab. Also to the south and the east, when the sun shone upon their marble walls, they could see the Greco-Roman cities of the Decapolis with their amphitheaters and pretentious temples. And when they lingered toward the going down of the sun to the west, they could make out the sailing vessels on the distant Mediterranean.
So, you know, bringing up liberal again here, you know, freedom to walk on the Sabbath.
Sure, right.
Again, just basic sort of freedoms, right, that are not there when you clamp everything down to a strict, humorless morality. You know, the first thing to just, you know, step back and go, whoa, this great, big, huge paragraph. Why are they going on and on and on about, you know, what you see in this direction, what you see in that direction? And, you know, we'll eventually get here shortly, too. Jesus was very, very curious about geography. Okay? And we could ask, you know, what's the chicken and what's the egg here? I mean, is he curious about geography because his father took him up on the hill all the time and, you know, he's fascinated looking around, or, you know, was it more innate? And that's why they like to go up the hill? But one way or another, they're talking about this predicate to this scientific curiosity he had about geography, just like he'd lay on his back and look at the stars, you know, his scientific curiosity about astronomy. Yeah, and again, it's, you know, the immediate material world, be it geography or astronomy, right? The earth or the heavens is an initial reflective basis to get reflective questions going. Huh, now, what exactly is the deal there? Does that cause that, or, you know, or what is the cause of that? And maybe it doesn't have anything to do with what's immediate in the surroundings at all. And, you know, getting causation going, and, you know, all of those bases for someone who has a personality-managed mind, someone who's spiritual and can be religious then.
I love how they detail some of these intimate associations with Jesus and his father. I mean, we know that he doesn't have a lot of them for a long period of time. And so when they talk about things like this that they both enjoy doing together, it's just, I kind of get a little emotional about it. I just feel grateful that they put some of that in here. You know, because I can imagine how difficult it must have been for Jesus to not have him early on.
Yeah, you know, talking about going on these jaunts, you know, like I was commenting before, back when, you know, basically everyone was going to church every Sunday and every kid was going to Sunday school every Sunday, well, there was also, a broad tradition that everyone would go for a Sunday drive. Jesus, you know, Joseph takes Jesus on a Sunday drive, you know, as it were, right? He got to spend a lot of time with his dad every Sabbath. So Sunday was Saturday, right? But, you know, every Sabbath, you know, not to mention all the time, you know, of him being in this workshop with his dad, and all those little things added up to a very significant foundation with his dad. And then, of course, we can't avoid mentioning, you know, many times Jesus heard his father relate the story of how Elijah dispatched those real estate agents. we often, you know, worry about, well, you know, what if my kids grow up with, you know, primitive stories about God and his doings with man? I mean, Jesus had the story of Elijah, you know, doing in all of those priests. You know, that was just burned into his brain. And he got the fusion.
Mm-hmm. You know, something precious I experienced this week, I found an app called Minnow, M-I-N-N-O, and it's Bible stories that are in cartoons, and they're really wholesome, a lot of really good stories, and they're humorous, and I have four-year-old twins, and my daughter, Rosalind, she just has an enormous religious curiosity, and after only a couple weeks of watching these cartoons periodically, we watch them before we go to bed every night, just for like 30 minutes. We were driving the other day, and there happened to be a huge rainbow that she saw outside of the car while we were driving. And she goes, "Daddy, that's a rainbow, and that's God's promise that he's never going to flood the planet again." And I was just floored. I couldn't believe that she had retained that at such a young age. And then my same week, my son had recounted a story about Joseph and how his brothers had sold him off and he went into slavery and all this stuff. And like these little stories that my children are watching, and I'm watching them with them, and I'm thinking, this is so good. And like, I always scoffed at the Bible, especially because I just discovered the Urantia book, and that was like the third book I ever read in my life. And so I thought, well, there's no need for this book then. I've got this book, and this supersedes everything that was in there. And man, just the richness that has been brought into both me and my children, my family as a whole, as a result of learning these stories in the Bible. And I thought it was relative to bring up here because it just reminded me of what we're talking about. But I'm so grateful for it.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that, David. Yeah.
Yeah.
And how you had to overcome an unfortunate initial thought that revelation is revolution.
Yeah.
No. Yeah. You know, it's part of evolution. It's constructed in an evolutional fashion. If it wasn't,
it presupposes you're familiar
yeah,
with
it presupposes
what came
it. And if it didn't synchronize with
read?
It, it would be rebellion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So, a 3-4-year-old kid can, identify, and recite many, many Bible passages.
Yeah.
And they become foundational elements in their life. Just like Isaiah 61:1 became the foundation for all of Jesus's life. That was his touchstone. Constantly. I mean, he was his touchstone, and at the ordination of the 12,
mm-hmm.
playing off of that, etc. Yeah, he's asked to read in the synagogue. Coincidentally, he opens up to Isaiah and reads chapter 61. Da-da.
From four directions, Jesus could observe the caravan trains as they wended their way in and out of Nazareth. And to the south, he could overlook the broad and fertile plain country of Esdraelon. Did I say it right, Chris? Did I get it?
Esdraelon.
Esdraelon. No, I was way off. Okay. The fertile plain country of Esdraelon, stretching off towards Mount Gilboa and Samaria.
So the kind of plains-like region that goes, that's sort of immediately to the south, stretching from east to west, from the Jordan to the sea, south of Mount Carmel. And then you go to the south of that, and you get to Mount Gilboa and Samaria.
By the way, just a quick plug, I don't have to name the product. It is not difficult with a modern computer to load up a 3D topographic relief map of this area. And I've just recently begun inhabiting this space a little better, like sort of looking around the Sea of Galilee. And I actually tried to pan it down and see what is the view from Nazareth. You can see Mount Hermon. And this is technology available to any of us with a computer or even a tablet device. So it's something that can enrich your understanding here.
Mm-hmm.
Or just a paper map.
Thanks for that.
Yeah, and again, just, you know, him, you know, see, not only again the geography, but, you know, bringing in the caravan trains. You know what I mean? They're coming from, you know, those the roads are coming from the northwest, the northeast, the you know, the southwest and the southeast. You know, it's this nexus point there in Nazareth. You know, and so he's getting a sense of, you know, of civilization and how it moves about the geography, and you know, he's getting all of this sophistication of reflective consideration. You know, again, you know, even, you know, Brad, you bringing up, you know, looking at things from a bird's eye point of view like that. See, again, seeing the forest for the trees, right? All these things that can facilitate having a reflective vantage point on your life and on the world.
When they did not climb the heights to view the distant landscape, they strolled through the countryside and studied nature and her various moods in accordance with the seasons. Jesus' earliest training, aside from that of the home hearth, had to do with the reverent and sympathetic contact with nature.
Reverent and sympathetic. You know, we often talk about how those things can be overplayed, okay, but they shouldn't be underplayed either. You know, Jesus is literally starting out, his sixth adjutant has an initial inclination to worship nature. And that doesn't make him evil or something, or doomed to iniquity. But, you know, that's a means to a higher end. It's not an end in itself. But just, you know, before, you know, there can be true worship, there has to be reverence of something. And before there can be true compassion, there has to be sympathy for someone, something. You have to start in the lower domain. Right? And then follow those impulses up, rather than making sympathy an end in itself or reverence an end in itself. Right? Mm. The reverence of unity is not the worship of God, for instance. But, again, all of this balance, and Justin, you were bringing up that balance, you know, early on in the show here.
Yeah, it's interesting to think of literally the sequence of fear, anguish, dread, awe, reverence, recognition, realization, appreciation, love, in the context of the human Jesus, literally him moving through those bottom levels of anguish and dread. We don't often associate those sort of lower end qualities to the master, but yet he did have to move up just like every other human.
Because he wasn't a fetish man, right? He was a real man, which means you start with fear, and then you get to anguish, and then you get to dread.
Before he was 8 years of age, he was known to all the mothers and young women of Nazareth, who had met him and talked with him at the spring, which was not far from his home, and which was one of the social centers of contact and gossip for the entire town. This year, Jesus learned to milk the family cow and care for the other animals. During this and the following year, he also learned to make cheese and to weave. When he was 10 years of age, he was an expert loom operator. It was about this time that Jesus and the neighbor boy Jacob became great friends of the potter who worked near the flowing spring. And as they watched Nathan's deft fingers mold the clay on the potter's wheel, many times both of them determined to be potters when they grew up. Nathan was very fond of the lads and often gave them clay to play with, seeking to stimulate their creative imaginations by suggesting competitive efforts and modeling various objects and animals.
Oh, well, that's going to lead to a problem with orthodoxy.
Even in Nazareth, yeah.
Because sometimes those Orthodox Jews from Judea come up and visit in Nazareth. We'll see that here shortly. So there's that. But again, just notice, I mean, over and over again, we have all these little vignettes of look at how much arts and sciences you have in Jesus' suffering, right? So that he's balanced, so he can achieve a moral consciousness that's the super additive consequence of some initial scientific consciousness balanced with some initial religious consciousness, right? As opposed to, just devolving, a religious consciousness into some, dogma and, and some rote so-called morality based on it. Right? It's something that faces facts, right? And has this sophisticated coordination in mind with all those facts. A cosmic morality.
It's just reminding me of the phrase supreme responsibility is really lighting up for me. That's what parents have here, a supreme responsibility. Balanced education to foster the growth of a cosmic citizen, a potential finality, and not setting them off on a tangent that's so false that they might not recover from it. We don't have to go down that rabbit hole, but it's all quite doable. God doesn't ask us anything of us that isn't possible, but this is a supreme responsibility. Parents should take it seriously.
And the reason that someone like Jesus, any child, can manifest these profound behaviors at such a young age is, again, because we're not just what was born. None of this is something that came out of Mary's womb. This is what was created in him, and it's beginning to bear fruit. And that balance between religious consciousness and scientific consciousness. Can you ever really have a religious consciousness if you haven't developed your first cosmic intuition to firmly discriminate fact from figment? Right. There's no real religious consciousness apart from the fact of God. Right. Yeah. If it's just some figment in your mind about, that you call God, then it's a so-called religious consciousness. It's just some sort of lower domain piety.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Some reverencing of your God notion. But, you can't really exercise the third cosmic intuition, your spiritual insight, apart from your first cosmic intuition, your logical acumen. Because you can't bring your religious, your spiritual insight to a focus, to a point, an acumen, without the first.
You need recognition, yes.
The third intuition, apart from the first, produces just an ever more diffusing, non-point-like thing, right? It turns your zeal into fanaticism, right? So, these arts and sciences, it's extremely important to being able to end up with a religious Jesus, someone who can focus his mind in on the fact of the real God.
And I can't even go without saying this. My 8-year-old son Nathaniel we're homeschooling now. I'm homeschooling. My wife goes to work, and I work from home. And I'm homeschooling him. And he's in a charter school, and one of the rules is that it has to be a secular curriculum. But of course, I can supplement with my own curriculum with him. And last week, one of his first assignments from his religious work was to write a short paragraph about the first cosmic intuition. And he read it, and he wrote some notes down and took some notes. And a lot of it, of course, at the beginning, he just copied some of the words he read in the book. But we talked about what he thought about what it meant. And he didn't understand some things, so we got in the dictionary together, and of course, the dictionary I have also has a pretty good etymology section in it, and we kind of talked a little bit about that. But I said, okay, so no more religious assignments this week. Instead, we're just going to continue to focus on that first assignment. And I want you to point out to me anytime you can think about something that might be related to that first cosmic insight that we had read about. And several times this week, he's brought it up. And specifically, the differentiation between something real and something not real. And, of course, you know, in my mind, I know it's fact and figment, but I don't want to give that to him. I want him to unearth that at some point slowly. But doing his required schoolwork and focusing on some of this religious work, I'm so grateful that we're reading this right now, because I'm going to continue this process of just admixing science and art and religious training throughout his curriculum. And his little brother and sister are going to be starting homeschooling next year. And so, like, you know, we're kind of exploring with Nathaniel on some of this, but our twins are going to, hopefully have a little bit more of a solid basis for this as well. And man, this is just spot on. This is perfect timing.
And again, you know, just simple things like, you know, see if you can care for animals like Jesus learned how to do well without a first cosmic intuition. Without some basic common sense. Yeah. It's not going to happen. Yeah. The animals will die.
Yeah. You know, we just got our first family.
All these things that, you know, children used to growing up on farms and ranches and stuff, I mean, so many things that used to just happen naturally. Now everyone is abstracted and knows nothing but, you know, what their thumbs poke at, you know, the device in their hand. They couldn't tell you the difference between the sun and the moon, let alone where's Jupiter tonight.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, all these things that you know are very detrimental to, you know, ending up with a child that will ever, you know, fall in love and strive to know God.
Section 6, his 8th year, 82. This was an interesting year at school. Although Jesus was not an unusual student, he was a diligent pupil and belonged to the more progressive third of the class, doing his work so well that he was excused from attendance 1 week out of each month. This week, he usually spent either with his fisherman uncle on the shores of the Sea of Galilee near Magdala, or on the farm of another uncle, his mother's brother, 5 miles south of Nazareth.
And make sure when you're reading, you stay close to your mic so it doesn't get too muted. Just the one quick thing to note there. You know, lest we start having some exalted notion, turning him into a fetish boy, Jesus was not an unusual student.
Right.
And he's in the more progressive third. And again, what we're talking about is, you know, the basics any child can do, right? And the you know, the finer points, you know, the better genetic children can do. This is not some sort of exceptional, unusual phenomenon. This is normal human development. It's not normal animal development, but it's normal human development.
Although his mother had become unduly anxious about his health and safety, she gradually became reconciled to these trips away from home. Jesus' uncles and aunts were all very fond of him, and there ensued a lively competition among them to secure his company for these monthly visits throughout this and immediately subsequent years. His first week's sojourn on his uncle's farm since infancy was in January of this year. The first week's fishing experience on the Sea of Galilee occurred in the month of May.
Yeah, remember how we read how they started out unduly anxious there? How Mary, you know, grabbed all the kids and ran to the farm, you know, to, so they didn't get the ailment.
Right.
So not only is it the first time since infancy, it's also the first time, you know, when his mom's eyes aren't saucers, you know, in panic.
Justin, would you like to take over reading?
Sure thing. Thanks, David. About this time, Jesus met a teacher of mathematics from Damascus. And learning some new techniques of numbers, he spent much time on mathematics for several years. He developed a keen sense of numbers, distances, and proportions.
Yeah, so not, you know, beginning to, you know, not just have the basic sense of causation and fact, okay, but beginning to analytically develop that insight, right? Spent much time on mathematics. You know, the three cosmic intuitions aren't magical things, you know, that you just sort of flick the switch and you've got them at full power. You have to take delight in cultivating. It takes years and years and years of practice. So again, Jesus's mind worked so well because he spent so much time as a child taking delight in cultivating the use of his three cosmic intuitions.
This would have served him very well as a leader, planning out their ministry efforts, going around. I know he delegated some of that to one of the apostles later in life. I forgot which one it was, the kind of the logistics coordinator. But certainly the idea of, well, if we're going to do that, it's going to take this long, and, well, we're going to need to have a treasury. We can't just do this all magically. A mathematical education, it seems implied that maybe this is not an average education. This was maybe a happy coincidence, this teacher that he got.
Again, it could only happen because they were very close to a lot of Greek influence.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? They weren't down in Judea where, you know, those Orthodox leaders were, you know, trying to push Greek influence as, you know, far at bay as they could.
Mm.
Yeah, and so someone with some Greek education in mathematics, which is significant indication. Remember, even way back then, that's a significant mathematical education. Can happen upon coincidentally. There's Jesus and a teacher from Damascus.
I can't even tell you how many times my own personal life and others I've heard say this as well, but like complain about, why am I learning math? I'll never use this in my life. This is not applicable. And I just had a recognition when Justin read that, you gave a little bit more of an explanation of it. Oh my gosh, I've been shunning away from this all my life, this prickly individual scientific thing that doesn't resonate with my natural propensity towards values and things of beauty.
I don't need anything that helps me draw closer to God.
Yeah,
you do.
Okay,
yeah.
I'm going to take it up. I'm going to take it up a notch, David, with the fun fact of the night. They referenced both the keen sense of numbers, distances, and proportions. And if you happen to go to the Oxford Dictionary in regards to proportion, it's a part considered in comparative relation to a whole.
Oh wow!
Just had to throw that in there. All right.
That's awesome.
Jesus began to enjoy his brother James very much, and by the end of this year had begun to teach him the alphabet.
The parts in relationship to the whole.
Right. Yeah.
That's the key of the alphabet. So you can't just have some fuzzy holistic notion, right? You need a firm focus on the parts, and then you need to put the conceptions together. Yeah. So, you know, and of course, there's obviously, you know, at the very first opportunity, now that his brother James is just old enough, Jesus becomes a teacher.
Teaching those not very far behind him, just which is
yeah,
a cosmic
exactly.
pattern. Yeah.
Yeah,
exactly. See, that's why it's a sentence unto its, you know, that one sentence is a whole paragraph, and it's why that's a paragraph unto itself, because how cosmically consequential that is. Right?
When you were touching on the supreme responsibility, Brad, it made me think of that exact paragraph 4.
Yeah, exactly.
This year, Jesus made arrangements to exchange dairy products for lessons on the harp. He had an unusual liking for everything musical. Later on, he did much to promote an interest in vocal music among his youthful associates. By the time he was 11 years of age, he had a skillful harpist. He was a skillful harpist and greatly enjoyed entertaining both family and friends with his extraordinary interpretations and able improvisations.
But for the humorless society he was born into, you know, what might have been there? He's a little bit of a prodigy here in this regard. Yeah, you know, notice that they said he was unusual in this case. But yeah, it is, isn't it just delightful to picture him and a group of youths singing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
While Jesus continued to make enviable progress at school, all did not run smoothly for either parents or teachers. He persisted in asking many embarrassing questions concerning both science and religion, particularly regarding geography and astronomy. He was especially insistent on finding out why there was a dry season and a rainy season in Palestine. Repeatedly, he sought the explanation for the great difference between the temperatures of Nazareth and the Jordan Valley. He simply never ceased to ask such intelligent but perplexing questions.
Okay, look at the hunger for, you know, causal explanations. I mean, you know, he's getting a hold of the first cosmic intuition quite significantly, even at this young age. It's just insatiable. I have to know the cause. It's like, well, if that causes that, well, what caused that first thing? You know, and then what caused that first thing? See, and that, you know from the revelation, where does that lead you to? The first cause.
Of course.
Takes you to God. See, if you get to God, you know, through seeking the first cause, you actually find the fact of God instead of just some pleasant notion about God that you happen to have in your head. You get the real God.
Yeah, what? Just the quick, my chance to do a cross-reference for the night. That's in paper 195. In the end, it leads the scientist straight back to the first great cause, the universal father of paradise. That's what the scientist ought to find in their pursuit of science, is God.
All lines of reasoning, you know, start on the sphere of logic and converge towards the nucleus of faith, the center.
Yeah.
His third brother, Simon, was born on Friday evening, April 14 of this year, AD 2.
The day of the week again.
Yeah. Of course.
Funny that.
I'll admit, Chris, I reread your essay on all these things, and once I found myself counting on my fingers and scratching my head like a monkey, I said, okay, this is still beyond me. I'm not getting it. I mean, I'm getting the gist of it, but I feel like I'm one step away from a spreadsheet, but Microsoft Excel doesn't handle dates before 1900, so whatever.
I got a few toes and fingers you can borrow, Brad, next time when you need it.
Yeah. Talk about embarrassing. Oh, well.
In February, Nahor, one of the teachers in a Jerusalem academy of the rabbis, came to Nazareth to observe Jesus, having been on a similar mission to Zacharias' home near Jerusalem. He came to Nazareth at the instigation of John's father. While at first he was somewhat shocked by Jesus' frankness and unconventional manner of relating himself to things religious, he attributed it to the remoteness of Galilee from the centers of Hebrew learning and culture, and advised Joseph and Mary to allow him to take Jesus back with him to Jerusalem, where he could have the advantages of education and training at the center of Jewish culture. Mary was half persuaded to consent. She was convinced her eldest son was to become the Messiah, the Jewish deliverer. Joseph hesitated. He was equally persuaded that Jesus was to grow up to become a man of destiny, but what that destiny would prove to be, he was profoundly uncertain. But he never really doubted that his son was to fulfill some great mission on earth. The more he thought about Nahor's advice, the more he questioned the wisdom of the proposed sojourn in Jerusalem.
Notice how the midwayers have verbiage there that harkens right back to, you know, post-Gabriel visit and Joseph trying to sort that out. He never really doubted, you know, that. We have this orthodoxy, right, coming upon Jesus. And you go, okay, unconventional manner of relating himself to things religious. Now, we just saw, two paragraphs back there before this is a little Simon paragraph. He isn't just asking questions concerning, embarrassing questions concerning religion, but both science and religion. Because both of those questions are together, there's a super additive consequence. Right? But just the fact that there's an interplay between science and religion in his mind is going to make his relating to things religious unconventional.
Sure.
He's going to be thinking, in logical, factual terms about God instead of just magical, dogmatic terms about God.
Yes.
None of this is because he's special. Every one of us has an encirclement in the Holy Spirit, exactly like his. Right? That initial encirclement that everyone gets is identical, transcendent of biology, and in nature and nurture. Everyone could do this if they would just take delight in cultivating, but it's sad to record.
One other thought. This is a fairly astounding idea to take an 8-year-old effectively to a junior boarding school. I don't know. I wish I knew more about Jewish culture at the time, how common or rare that might be. Maybe they found precocious children in outlying areas and brought them to Jerusalem and had a whole system. I wonder how exceptional this might have been.
You can go to Africa today and, you're out in the bush somewhere and, your kid goes way off over there to go to school.
Yeah.
They don't go back and forth every day.
No, it's a couple day. It's a several day trek to Jerusalem by foot here. So yeah, you could go back on. Yeah, still though, that's a lot for an 8-year old. But
you get lots of people on the planet. Little kids go off to school, and after the semester they come home. Mom and dad get to see them again.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
You know, when they describe the shock, Nahor's shock, in the frankness in his unconventional manner of relating himself to things religious, it's almost as if Jesus knows whereof he speaks or questions, and this individual is somewhat shocked by the self by something being self-evident in a young child.
Again, you don't have the exaltation of mystery. I mean, no, he's got a logical mind, and some things are just definitive.
Yeah.
I'm shocked, Chris, at how frankly you talk about things in your answer book. It's like, well, that's the whole point. It's to eliminate all confusion and get a clear recognition and speak it directly.
Coordination of essential knowledge. Because of this difference of opinion between Joseph and Mary, Naor requested permission to lay the whole matter before Jesus. Jesus listened attentively, talked with Joseph, Mary, and a neighbor, Jacob the stonemason, whose son was his favorite playmate, and then, 2 days later, reported that since there was such a difference of opinion among his parents and advisors, and since he did not feel competent to assume the responsibility for such a decision, not feeling strongly one way or the other, in view of the whole situation, he had finally decided to talk with my father, who was in heaven. And while he was not perfectly sure about the answer, he rather felt he should remain at home with my father and mother, adding, "They who love me so much should be able to do more for me and guide me more safely than strangers who can only view my body and observe my mind, but can hardly truly know me." They all marveled, and Naor went his way back to Jerusalem. And it was many years before the subject of Jesus going away from home again came up for consideration.
See how reflective he is already?
Yes.
You know, and how logical he is. You know, it's like, well, you know, see, he isn't delusional where he prays. It's like, oh, and I heard God give me the answer. No, he's not in some magical, delusional state in his thoughts about God. Well, he was not perfectly sure about the answer, okay? But again, it's just how profoundly, they marveled because how profoundly reflective he was already. You know, how much favorable conditions had led to growth.
Yes.
Right? An animal grows kind of arithmetically. A human can grow geometrically.
Mm.
And that's what you're seeing with Jesus. You know, he's going forward by leaps and bounds.
And the conclusion he comes to involves personal relationships, the significance of being guided in those relationships.
And honor your father and your mother is still playing very strongly there. See?
Yeah.
The Ten Commandments are still his touchstone, and wise guide.
Wow.
Well, it makes me wonder, you know, whether someone like Nahor on his trip back to Jerusalem, you know, would he have just, you know, would he have gone, well, that's kind of cause for. He was marveling, but you wonder, did he actually pause and say, well, maybe there's something interesting going on there? Or did he just sort of shake his head and say, what a silly place this Nazareth is? You wonder, did he have any recognition? So, who knows?
Yeah. Maybe, but, you know, obviously, you know, there's also a strong possibility that he just hardened himself, you know, ever more rigidly to the pre-established line, his orthodoxy.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I do one thing in his defense that I did appreciate is the fact that he requested permission to lay the whole matter before Jesus.
Yep.
I think that there's something significant about that.
Yeah. Just the fact that Jesus brought in, you know, not his friend Jacob, but his dad Jacob.
Yeah.
You're right.
Wow. Okay.
Right. Got the whole committee together. Yeah. All right. Well, we'll have to leave it there. Fantastic study. Thank you all especially for sharing some of these stories. A couple of them really stuck with me from your own lives about parenting. We'll see you back here next week. Do your best to follow the way and listen to the podcast on Fridays if you care to. Good night.
God bless you, everybody.
Take care, everyone.
Yes. Love you all. Great to have you joining us every week like this. Tune back in, and we'll continue on with Jesus' life as he matures by leaps and bounds.